C1M. Number 3B.
So, in the first paragraph, The Soul of Mind, she postulates this widening out of interest by saying that to happify existence by constant intercourse with souls adapted to elevate it should be the motive of society. She speaks about society, not about just husband and wife. She speaks about society, about everyone, about every partner in the universe, and asks for unity of spirit and says that unity of spirit gives new pinions to joy. Gives new pinions to see again, we see the moment we touch one of these qualities, at that very moment life springs into action and says, I make everything new. The moment you touch being, something new is going to happen. Gives new pinions to joy. Whereas the other side, or else, joys, drooping wings, trailing to dust. There is destruction. There is death. There is something destructive happening. Then, in the second paragraph, you have that ill-arranged note produced discord. It says the tones of the human mind may be different, so it doesn't matter if the tones of the human mind are different. If our individuality is different, that we are different than we are. But that shouldn't be a hindrance for a unity of interest. Tones of the human mind may be different, but they should be concordant in order to blend properly. But how can they blend properly? What is necessary that they can blend properly, those different tones? What is it that can make us all together blend, though each one is different? She says, well, it is unselfish ambition. Must first be unselfish. The ego must be out of the question. And then come all those noble qualities of noble life motives and purity. These constituents of thought mingling constitute individually or collectively through happiness, strength, and permanence. So we see that only the blending of unselfish qualities alone can produce conquer. She asks that our mind becomes unselfish, that our mind becomes wise, thought, that we really mingle with souls and have contact with souls who have a progressive mind, a cultured mind, who can elevate existence. Then she says, yes, but can we have concord with these different people? They are so different, but can we have any harmony with them? She says, so it comes to spirit, to the second subtone. Spirit says, yes, they blend naturally and harmoniously, individually and collectively, if they are pure in their selflessness. That no selfish motive must enter in. The moment a selfish motive enters in, then one has discord. And one has a feeling the other one knows more than I do, the other one is better than I do, and then one makes classifications, separations, and then the whole trouble starts. Whereas, if we, you see, she impersonalizes always every relationship and brings it back not to person, but to qualities. And the moment we see the relationship of qualities and not of people, then we can have a true blending of qualities and interests.
And it goes further to the third, the soul of souls, where she brings in now the freedom. She says, that's all right, first, that we have contact with people who have a wide horizon and who think further than their nose. And she says, second, yes, and in order to be in concord and in harmony with them, we must have pure affections for these thoughts, for these concepts. Our ambition must be selfless and pure. And then, as the third, it comes in the necessity to have moral freedom in this unity of spirit, that there is no sense of domination and thereby suffocating one another. There must be, what she says here, moral freedom in soul. There can be no such thing as to contract the horizon of a worthy outlook by the selfish exaction of an all another's time and thought. Without additional choice, benevolence should grow more diffusive. The narrowness and jealousy, see, that's the counterfeit of soul to soul. The narrowness and jealousy which would confine a wife or a husband forever within four walls will not produce the sweet interchange of confidence and love, but on the other hand, a wandering desire for incessant amusement outside the home circle is a pure augury for the happiness of wedlock. Home is the dearest spot on earth, and it should be the center, the goal, not the boundary of the affection. So we can see what she says here, what is necessary for the unity of interest and for a identity of interest is that not one is going to control the other, that not one is going to restrict the other, that there is mutual confidence reigning from one to another, and that there is no confinement, neither within four walls, nor in a certain place, nor into a certain ability or anything. Let each one be identified as a free agent of God. Then there is moral freedom. Then there is harmony. Then there is possibility of harmony. Where so often we see that the one who thinks to have a higher aim and a nobler life motive and seems to be a better character, that he is going to doubt the other, to confine the other, to restrict the other in his way, on his activities, and in any way to limit him. Not that we don't trust him instead of giving the confidence. Not to trust him that as a free agent he can express God in his individual way. So there is a big lesson to be learned in this point, that there is freedom without domination, without personal domination, personal confinement, without taking each other's energy and time and thoughts and resources and I don't know what. Then he goes further to soul as principle, and here she brings in the sense of being under obligation to care for one another. Actually, as we begin to see that all our interests are wedded into one interest, and the more we would see that, the lovelier it would really be. And I think we all strive and we all struggle to see that, that everyone really is part of a whole, and that everyone's interest is wedded into one big common interest. And in seeing that and leaving enough freedom to each one within that range of duty, principle comes in and says, yes, but as it is all one interest, there is the obligation to care for one another, to care for each other. So happiness really involves the obligation of mutual care and mutual solicitude. It isn't the sense of exploiting each other. See, just as the peasant bride said to her lover that two eat no more together than they eat separately, she had a true sense of not exploiting one another. See, quite important. All this would really apply to communism, to the true sense of communism, and also really exposes the false sense of communism. This starting with a common interest, seeing that in one common interest we all are wedded together, that we are all in the same boat, so to say, and that the prosperity of each one of us is dependent on the care and solicitude of which each other gives to one. But then principle must come in and give to this one common interest a principled attitude, a principled obligation. Or it turns out to be one big exploitation, where one class exploits the other on the ground of one common cause. And so it is in the big and in the smaller circles. Principle comes in and asks for the enduring obligations on both sides, not only on one side. Matrimony should never be entered into without a full recognition of its enduring obligations on both sides. There should be the most tender solicitude for each other's happiness, mutual attention, and so on. Then she gives a last subtone of soulless life, where she brings out within the range of this mutual caring and the obligation of mutual care, she brings out the sense of life, of true individuality, that in this caring for each other, we are not dominating the other and are not taking away the individuality of the other, but that we live within the united, she speaks of the united sphere, that within the united sphere we leave the individual to develop in his own way and support his individual development without giving up one's own individuality. See, the wrong sense of it one sees so often in a marriage, that one partner gives up his or her individuality completely in order to support the other partner's individuality and success. Now that is not soulless life. That would be a killing of one of the two individualities. The art is to have each partner's individuality to be developed individually, but being supported by the other in his development, without naturally neglecting one's own development. He speaks here fulfilling the different demands. They are different, see, Whereas so often one sees that two people, two or more people, are just interested in one sphere, in one demand, instead that each one keeps his or her individuality and works out that individuality, but works it out within a united sphere, fulfilling the different demands of their united spheres. Their sympathies should blend in sweet confidence and cheer, each partner sustaining the other, thus hallowing the union of interests and affection, and so on. So can we see the sense of soul as life, soul which unites all common, all interests into one common interest, but it doesn't kill the individuality. Within that one common interest, there is plenty of room for the development of each individuality, for each individual aspect of life. And the beauty would be if we had the bigness to support and value and appreciate the other's individuality and contribution to the whole, without giving up one's own individual contribution. Under such circumstances, she says, can happiness be established? Can happiness be established? Because then not one is suffering under the other. Not one has to stand back, so to say, in his or her individual development, so that only the other's individual development can be nurtured and sustained and supported. Well, that ends the subject of soul. You get a bit tired. I tell you a joke. I tell you a joke about soul as life in marriage. There was a friend who came to the other friend and he said, "I always see that you have a harmonious home, and I at home I have always quarreled. Now tell me, why have you always harmony at home?" So he said, "Well, that's very simple, you know. You know, when we married, we made an agreement that in our common sphere we have two different obligations. My wife, we decided, would make all decisions on minor questions, and I would make all the decisions on major questions." And so that friend said, Oh, that's why you never have quarrels." He said, "Yes, works very fine." So he said, "What are the minor questions which your wife has to decide?" So he said, "Well, you see, for instance, to which school the children should go, or if I should change my job." So he said, "Oh." He said, "And what are then the major questions which you have to decide?" He said, "Oh, well, for instance, if Red China should be a member of the United Nations." So that's fulfilling, what did you say? Fulfilling the different demands of their united sphere. Having a wonderful sense of harmony. All right, and just to end this subject, let's see how it develops out of prayer and atonement and Eucharist. In prayer, we had that prayer of sincerity in order to bring about reformation in us. But the Atonement and Eucharist comes and
brings the demand to pursue the way from sense to soul, that there is no reformation, that there is no sincerity which brings reformation unless there is the fulfilling of the demand really to go actually from sense to soul. But in the measure that I go the way from sense to soul, in that measure myself becomes less selfish and more of the nature of one, of that one common interest of soul. So atonement and Eucharist brings us more and more away from sense and therefore from self, and makes us more selfless. So there is again, we see again in prayer and in atonement and Eucharist, the source from which we draw our selflessness. It isn't a moral effort again where we say, well, I have to be a bit more selfless now. But how? Well, always through prayer, through that willingness to change first, to reform. That willingness to reform brings in atonement and Eucharist that first subject which says, all right, then go the way from sense to soul. Stick to that. Go step by step, persevering, go away from sense and go towards soul. That makes me more selfless. And the more I'm selfless, the more I begin to use selflessness in marriage, as a third subject in marriage. And that selflessness in marriage shows me that this brings to me a newer, higher, wider, and richer sense of happiness and joy and harmony in relationships. Well, here we stop for 5 minutes.